Hi, everybody. It's Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Welcome back to the podcast. We are super thrilled. We are super excited to speak to our next guest, Stephanie Ekonomou. She is a fantastically gifted composer. She's traveled the galaxy. She is tall in stature and wide in vision. She plays a mean violin. So we would like very much to welcome Stephanie to the show.
Thanks, Mark. Hell of an intro. I appreciate it.
Well, gifted artisan, why don't we start off with a fun question? If you could have your own superpower and a funny name, what would you give yourself?
Ooh, excellent question. I think I would love to be able to just be able to come up with the best quips and insults possible to just really embarrassingly insult people. I think that would be just like a super fun superpower to just take anyone down. So more of like a, I don't know, wondrous wordsmith or something. That's the lamest thing I could have possibly come up with. But yeah, I'd love to be able to just take anyone out just with words.
So you're essentially Don Rickles at that point. Just
yes,
the fastest mind on the
precisely. Planet. Yes. Yeah. God, I would love to have just a shred of what Don Rickles has.
Well, we always like to discuss people's careers, but as with anything, we want to get to the roots of what got you interested. And I think talking to you about your work on the superhero show, I think this is a perfect segue to say, let's hear Stephanie's origin story. So why don't you tell us and the listeners, what got you into music? You know, which string on a violin is your favorite? What gets you up in the morning and makes you go to work?
Sure, yeah. So yeah, I try to treat all violin strings equally. So I can't choose a favorite on that front. The E string's terrible. I can't stand the E string, truly. I grew up, luckily, not as an orphan. So, you know, not a terribly dramatic origin story. But yeah, I grew up on Long Island in New York, and I grew up playing piano and violin. I was never super great at piano, but violin kind of just stuck. And I went to this really awesome public high school on Long Island, and they had an excellent music theory and composition program, which is quite rare. And so I kind of got into writing music around that time, kind of freshman year of high school. And I had a great teacher named Mr. Doyle, who sort of just really nurtured that talent and pushed me to just keep writing music. And from there, I decided to apply to a conservatory. I went to New England Conservatory in Boston for my undergraduate degree, just in concert composing. So at that point, I wasn't specializing in film scoring or media composing or anything like that. And I kind of wrote more concert music, some orchestral music. And I had a couple friends who I had gone to high school with who were filmmakers just right down the road at Emerson in Boston. And they were like, we have a couple of these short films. Like, do you want to try just like writing some music for them? So I was like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but sure, why not? And I've always loved film and TV so much and obviously loved that music. So I kind of just like tried my hand at it. And I was like, this feels like what I want to do. It was a little bit of a struggle in conservatory for me because, you know, so much of my life I'm sitting isolated alone, creating what feels like very self-important music. And writing concert music for me was just like getting stuck in my own head. And I'm like, you shouldn't be in there. Just like, I don't wish that on anyone to get stuck in my head. It's just not the most fun place to be for the most part. I just felt like I was just craving some sort of outside collaborative relationship. And I really got that from scoring these short films. Some of these directors at Emerson were just like, yeah, pushing me to do things and challenging me to push the boundaries of what I felt was right for a scene and playing with pacing and playing with things stylistically. And it just got me really excited about music again. And after that, I was like, okay, let me try to specialize in film scoring. So I came out to LA and I got my master's degree in scoring for visual media at UCLA. And from there, this is such a riveting story. From there, I met Harry Gregson-Williams, who's a very prolific, wonderful composer. He was kind of rebuilding his team at that time. And he asked me to come work for him part-time while I was finishing up my degree. And I ended up working for him for 6 years as his composing assistant. So that kind of just like all took off from there. I always say I grew up at Harry's. Like, that's a phrase I always find myself saying, because I truly did. There's nothing like learning on the job from someone who is so gifted and generous like Harry. And from someone who is so diverse, right? So, I mean, he's the kind of composer that has done animations and thrillers and action films and small indie features and stuff. So being able to really hone my skills under someone like that was super crucial, because I felt like I was always challenged. And, you know, like when we sat down to do like an indie surfing movie, I was like, do we know how to do this? Do I know how to do this? Not really, but I'll figure it out. And, you know, we did some cool rock stuff for that, and just totally different ensemble and instrumentation than Harry's even ever done on that film. So being able to be stretched and get experience working in so many different stylistic palettes, I feel is what continues to excite me. But it also has set me up very well for now that I'm not with Harry any longer, doing my own projects, being able to kind of harness those different mediums, I think is kind of the best thing for an emerging up and coming composer. So that's where we are.
Fantastic. And I think, you know, if someone is going to teach you the ropes, it's the guy who's worked with Tony Scott and Ridley Scott and
totally
Anton Fuqua. If that sounds like a curse word, really, that's the way his name is. But it's phenomenal. And I think that, so 6 years ago, does that mean you worked on The Martian?
I did indeed. Yeah, that was one of the first and bigger, studio films that I ever had the pleasure of working on. So yeah, what a one to kind of start on. I mean, we had a couple before that, but that was such a fantastic process working on that film. It was really rewarding, and just seeing, you know, Harry so in his element, and with Ridley, you know, obviously having such a great established rapport there creatively, it was just fun. And everybody knew how wonderful the project was. So it was just such smooth sailing from start to finish. And there was just such great trust in the vision. And, you know, being able to record it at Abbey Road, where all the players were just like so into the music, as they always are, it was a really awesome, rewarding process.
And he's somebody that, you know, I find that composers are very humble a lot of times, like you said, because they work in a silo. And you know, it's sometimes tough to think outside the box or get other people's opinions. But the way I heard him talk about working with young Steve Jablonski, he's so willing to give people a leg up, you know, give them an opportunity to play around with the equipment. And so I would love to ask more questions about the conservatory, but let's just keep going with the Harry thing. So what were some of the first conversations you had? How involved did you get, and what kind of landing pad or launch pad did he provide?
Yeah, I mean, you really hit the nail on the head with that, because Harry is definitely one of the most generous composers as a mentor. You know, I can tell you very convincingly that not every composer is like that with their assistants or with their additional writers. Harry always saw me as someone that he wanted to like bring up under his wing and kind of just like take me everywhere he went and create visibility for me, which is really wonderful. When I started out with him, he was really just looking to hire someone part-time to help around the studio, because they were on, he was on a bit of a scary project at that time called Black Hat. It was just very, very demanding. And because he had just kind of started over, he had taken a sabbatical, gotten rid of his whole team, his whole studio. And then he came back after a year and he was kind of starting to take on projects again. He was rebuilding his team. So he had one assistant, a tech studio assistant that he had hired named Paul Thomason, who was my coworker for 6 years, very, very close friend. And he was like, we kind of really need another set of hands. So he just kind of called up my professor and was like, is Steph free to just kind of come here part-time for a little bit, just for some like mundane tasks? And I was so excited about it. And, you know, in my first meeting interview with him, I guess you could say, he was basically like, listen, I know you're a music student. Like, I've heard your music. I know you don't want to just be like, you know, plugging in cables all day or like writing down serial numbers. I understand that. But he's like, you know, little by little, just like sit in the back of the room and like watch me work and just be a sponge, essentially, is what he was telling me. He was like, I know what your goals are ultimately. And I, you know, let's just start out here and see how it goes. And that's really what it was. It was Paul kind of showing me the ropes and me kind of watching Harry work and him being very generous and explaining part of his process and just the way that he likes things to be. And little by little, you know, I wasn't writing for him until maybe like 8 months in or something like that. So for the first 8 months, I was sort of doing those studio tasks, you know, buying new sample libraries, updating the template, handling picture turnovers and editing cues and stuff like that. So the more creative liberty he gave me, the more he could see, like, are you going to sink or swim kind of thing. And I think, like, luckily he saw something that was like, yeah, like I can foster this. I was so green, you know, he really took a chance on me. And I think that's really on him for doing that, because for such a well-established composer who is really starting to build a team again, you know, he could have hired someone who had a lot more experience coming into it, and he didn't. He tends to not do that. He likes to create a mentorship relationship with people, and that's kind of why people stick around with Harry for a long time. You'll see that a lot of his former writers or assistants, like, are there for many, many years. And I can confidently say assistant work is not very sustainable. It's a very, very tough job. It's a lot of hours. It's a lot of just like stress and anxiety and intensity. But people stay with Harry because he offers that sense of sort of nurturing for a young composer. He was always so transparent with the studios, the directors, whoever was in the room for a meeting. He would always involve me in the conversation. He would always be like, Steph is my composing assistant. And he made me part of the conversation at all times. So when we got to the scoring stage and we were recording something, I was always his booth reader. I was in the booth. I was in there with the mixer. I was in there with the director a lot of the time. There was a sense of a relationship being established and a sense of trust, like, okay, she's Harry's second set of ears kind of thing. And he would throw me up on the conducting podium to conduct some cues. You always do that on scoring sessions. So gaining visibility with the players, whether we're in LA or we're in London, you know, or we're up in wherever it is. And I think that speaks volumes to how much he really does care about my future and my career beyond my work with him. So again, I could not be more grateful for having a start like that and for growing up there, you know? And that's definitely a lifelong just kind of creative bond that we will have, because when you have such a small team like we had at Harry's, where it was just me, him, and Paul, you go through everything together and it's rough and it's challenging. But again, there's that trust that is involved and in creating the music. So it was pretty wonderful. And I feel so much more set up having been with him for 6 years and him offering that visibility to me and transparency. Now that I'm freelance and on my own, I feel like I could firmly stand on my own 2 feet because I had these contacts because of him. And he's always like, oh, hey, I can't do this project, can you? Or just always trying to involve me. And I mean, it's such a wonderful way to kind of get an introduction into this industry. And not a lot of people have that. So I certainly recognize how rare that is, and very grateful to have had that upbringing.
And I guess out of all people in the world to be your sort of mentor, and the reason he likes to foster those relationships, that's probably why he has 6 kids. He likes to watch people grow.
He and sure so. Does. Yeah, he loves that. He's such a wonderful father, and yeah, he just loves. Yeah, I think he would adopt like 100 kids. So he absolutely loves fostering that kind of warm, wonderful environment.
So back to your origin story, the piano and the violin, stringed instruments. It's funny, I don't think I've ever heard a composer say, well, I started off on marimbas and didgeridoos, and now I'm scoring film music. There's always like, there seems to be a commonality between whether it's a guitar, a violin, or piano. I wonder, what makes that connection, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, thinking about being a kid, I remember being about 7 years old and really saying to my parents, like, I really want to learn the piano. I don't know where that came from, to be honest, but I just wanted to like bang on something and have it make noise. That could also be a marimba potentially, honestly. But for me, it was the piano. And they got me like a tiny little keyboard and I loved it. And then it got to the point where they're like, okay, we'll see. She sounds like shit. We got to get her lessons. So I think that's kind of, that's kind of where that started. But they got me lessons. I took piano lessons for, I don't know, 13 years, maybe. I never got to like any sort of elite level in piano just because there was something about it that it wasn't my instrument, but such a crucial tool for being able to compose. Like I still compose on piano. That's still my primary instrument that I compose on. It's visual. It's like easy to kind of just like work out ideas on. So those piano lessons still serve me well, even if I'm not a pianist by any stretch. And I think I ended up playing violin. I ended up playing violin because my older sister played viola and she was so good at viola. And I was young. I'm younger by 2.5 years. So she would teach me like how to hold the bow and show me these like fun exercises. So I already felt like I knew that I wanted to do that because I had seen her kind of playing in orchestras and it really excited me. My sister really wanted to play the bass and my parents were like, that's way too big. We're not doing that. So she ended up with viola. she will always talk about that. But yeah, I think she was the one that really inspired me to want to play violin. And then we grew up kind of playing duets together and stuff like that. So I think when you're a kid, there's a lot of just seeing someone do it and being like, I want to do that thing. Or, you know, someone like hearing a guitar solo and being like, I want to be a rock star and doing that kind of thing. I have many friends who are percussionists and I know that their kids are just going to grow up banging on all of this stuff and they're going to end up being percussionists. So it's very much the environment that you grow up in, I think, or just, seeing someone do something and being like, that looks like a cool, fun thing to try. So there's lots of film composers who come from the rock world or come from the pop world. You know, there's a lot of that goes into it, but, growing up playing violin and playing in ensembles was the biggest thing that fostered my love of music. Just making music with other people, I think, is the thing that created that love. And it was mostly classical music. It was mostly symphonies and stuff like that. And now to the point where when I transitioned mainly into composing, time becomes this vortex and you don't know what happens and 6 years go by and like, it's just, I was with Harry and now I'm not with Harry. And it's, you have these moments where you're lucid and you take a step back and gain perspective. And you're like, I am just like sitting in a room alone, making music again, you know, just like what happened? I got into this because I wanted the sense of collaboration and it's there, but still like 90% of the time I'm sitting here making music alone. And the main joy that comes out of being a composer now is when I get to involve people and make music with them. So like I get to call up my friends who are my regular collaborators and be like, hey, you know, my best friend Ari Mason, who's an incredible singer and viola da gamba player, she plays anything on all of my scores. It doesn't matter. She's just so versatile. I'll just call her up and be like, I'm so stuck on this cue. It's so bad. Just do you have any ideas if I send it to you? And she'll be like, yeah, sure. And then send me back a bunch of wild, incredible ideas. And it just blows the whole thing open for me. So I think thinking about making music in an orchestra and just playing this incredible repertoire and then not doing that and becoming a composer, like, and then realizing that's like the thing that made me love music is just making music with other people. That's the key to any sort of joy for me in this, is finding like a core group of musicians that you just love sending stuff to, or you love getting stuff back from, and they create something special. They really open up that dimension of the music so that it's not so much this isolated, weird creation from my brain that feels terrible. it's something more. There's depth to it because someone else has breathed life into it and it brought something else to the table. So yeah, a long-winded way of saying playing in orchestras really is what the joy was for me. And then even transitioning into writing music alone, that's still a joy. Even if it's not performing live, it's still that sense of creating something organic with another human being.
Well, that's important because the collaboration, as you said, it does take things to not the next level, but it helps you expand out of your comfort zone, make you totally. Think about things you didn't, you know, a corner that you weren't thinking about turning. But that's kind of one of the questions I want to go back to when you were writing short music for short films. A lot of times there's the idea that your first answer is your best answer. So how closely after you graduated, if you got your master's and worked with Harry, do you still kind of feel that barring the collaboration, do you still feel like once you hit it once, that's kind of your best take on it and everything, maybe it's derivative or maybe falls off? Like, how do you have, I know it's a big long-winded question, but do you feel like you're confident with your first take or you need people's input to really make something sing?
Like first version of something, you mean? Like my yeah. first kind of attack at something? Mm-hmm. I can confidently tell you that my first attempt at a cue is definitely not always the best. It's definitely not. Looking at it on a grander scale, you know, finishing like a TV score and then moving on to something else, oftentimes I'll look back on the TV score and be like, what was that crap? That's terrible. Like that, I don't want to do that again. Right. So, there's a lot of, for me, I very much fear the derivative. It scares me. Like, creative industries are so oversaturated. The music industry is so oversaturated, that to the point where, you know, people are hearing a cue in a temp track over and over again, everybody's hearing it, everybody's ripping it off, and now the ripoffs are in the temp track. And it's just like this postmodern cycle of what is meaning anymore? What is music anymore? What is this? What are we creating? And I really try to have the self-awareness to understand that, like, if I'm making disingenuous music or I'm just making a Xerox of something else, it's really upsetting, like deeply upsetting to me. And unfortunately, sometimes that's the case in this industry. Sometimes you have to do that a little bit. But for me, like, I really try to sit down and create something different for the project that I'm on. I don't like making the same thing over and over again. And that's why I loved working with Harry so much, because we were doing different things all the time. And that's very fulfilling artistically, I feel. So like if I sit down and start a cue, if my first version, I feel like I'm just gravitating towards the same stuff that I always do, like the same tools, the same sounds, the same process, I tend to get like a little itchy. I don't like it. It's sometimes you have to, just out of necessity. If it's a really tight TV schedule, you know, you have to be able to rely on those tools. And I totally understand that. But I think like the more that I spend time on a project or the more versions I get into something, like the better I am at just like pushing myself out and trying to do something else. So like getting down an initial idea, if it feels derivative to me or I know it's derivative when it's coming out, I know that there's more work to be done. Like I know I have to push for another, like just take another stab at it or just like keep like cracking away at it. That's like quite important to me, to try to just at least create something unique or original for me in everything, whether it's like original on like globally. No, nothing's original, right? It's all just an amalgam of everything, right? But that's a really important thing for me to be aware of, because the self-loathing is like is bad. Like I think for any creative person, it's hard to overcome sometimes. So if I feel like I'm continuing to write the same thing or everything's version 1.01 and it's all just like feels the same, I die a little bit inside. It's not great for me. Sometimes version 1.01 is different and I don't need to do that. But you know, that's not always the case. Sometimes just something comes out and it's like, yeah, this feels like something I've written a billion times before. And I don't love the idea of that. And that's really when performers can help get you out of that comfort zone, like you said. You know, just having someone record something on it and be like, okay, that's actually influencing me to change a lot of these things. It's challenging my perception of what I thought this could be. That's a very roundabout way of not really answering your question, but I think like that's an important thing to talk about. It's a question that's important for all creatives to think about. because so often we're just trying to get to the deadline, or we're just trying to make it work for the showrunner or the director. And you have to make concessions everywhere. Sure, that's just the practicality of the industry. But I think if we're not trying to sit down and challenge ourselves to create something different or change the landscape or invite diverse voices to help do that, then it just seems like it's all a little pointless, and it's just going to keep going this like cyclone of it's all the same cue over and over again, right? Sure. So yeah, that's kind of the way I feel about it.
Well, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because what I do for this podcast, this website, is a hobby. I'm actually in architecture, and I work on hotels and resorts, and mostly extensively hospitality projects. And I'm working on one project right now where you kind of have the guts of a hotel. You have the bar, you have the restaurant, check-in, and it's how you sort of Swiss watch those, you know. And sometimes you just feel when you go into a space, well, based on the way the sun comes in or where the drop-off is, the bar should be here. Reception is here. And so that's kind of what I was getting at, maybe your first couple stabs. But then again, exactly like you said, if you look at it and it's version 1.01 or 1.02, I go to my confidant and I say, what do you think about this? And he goes, put the toilet there. And I go, I've been looking at this plan for 3 days. I could have come to you and get an answer in 3 seconds. It's
totally,
you know, but
yeah. Yep. That just, it goes that way sometimes, and it's, it's wild, but it happens all the time.
Well, let's use that friendly collaboration and relationship talk to segue into Jupiter's Legacy, where a team of superheroes helps each other out, fights each other. You have to see it, and we're not going to spoil anything, but it is a superhero film. So when you talk about things are derivative, things are redone, I think what was refreshing about this show, it made me interested in superheroes at a point where I feel like I'm getting superhero fatigue. So what was your first take on this, and especially being a Mark Millar property? What were some of your first thoughts?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think there are a lot of people that are having that superhero fatigue. And I didn't know about the comic series before I got pulled onto it. I wasn't familiar with it. So reading a couple of the first couple scripts, which they sent me well before I saw any picture or anything, I was like, this is interesting. You know, it has those elements of, it has the scope of the superhero narrative, but the actual story itself is very much kind of like a family drama. There are these like very tense, intimate moments that they explore between these families that is really what kind of drives the story. It's the complexities of our relationships with, you know, our parents or our children or our siblings, and put that through the lens of they also have powers, you know? And the older generation of superheroes, so Sheldon, the Utopian, played by Josh Duhamel, he's like from that old world. Like they gained their powers in the 1920s and the 1930s, right? And flash forward to present day, 100 years later or so, their kids also have powers, and they're trying to contend with the fact that the world has drastically changed, right? These kind of antiquated rules that the union has put into place don't really apply anymore. And, you know, it's that sort of global stress that is placed on the union, coupled with this dynamic of the younger generation and the older generation, and like how to really move forward if this is this antiquated kind of union justice is holding them back. It's a different way of telling this story, and it feels very topical. And yeah, like quite, like I think there are a lot of people that can see themselves in these characters. So when I first kind of got pulled onto it, I was instantly kind of drawn to that element of the story. That plus the fact that, you know, we're hopping time periods all the time and we're moving locations, and it just felt like a really wild, interesting, diverse story that I knew that the music needed to really live up to the scale of that. So I was excited by all of these characters and being able to write themes for them, and just trying to do something different and a little bit off the beaten path for a superhero score that you would think, given the fact that the story is kind of telling it through a different lens.
And I'm glad you brought up the family dynamic, because I think that's what, in a different genre, that's what makes horror so effective. It's not just the spooking or the slashing. It's how it affects people's psyches, drives families apart, and, you know, really weighs on relationships. But there's a couple quotes from the show that I really gravitated towards. There's one that says, where Utopian says, "What's the use of doing good when no one perceives it that way?" And then later on, his wife says something to the effect of, "The code doesn't make our lives easier. It's never about taking the easy way out." Mm-hmm. And then there's also ideas about how the nation's on edge, it's spiraling. And it kind of speaks to, there's so much more than just, I have a power and I'm going to stop that guy from robbing a bank. It's really, really, it can even be a soap opera at times.
Yeah.
So the one, I'm glad you brought up the time jumping. That's the thing that I had probably the biggest difficulty with the show. Not to say I can't follow a non-linear story, but it just feels that it was cut up a little more than it should. So I'm wondering, how difficult was that to try to, you know, you don't want to do something in the, you know, 2020 and then go to 1920 and just have this juxtaposition of instruments. So how was that blanket acoustically laid?
Yeah, that was something we had discussed very, very early on in the process before I had even written anything. It was really important to the showrunner, Sang-Kyu Kim, that we don't comment musically on the time period jumps. He wanted it to feel cohesive, like it was all part of the same story, because it is. So, you know, not having like a bunch of like Big Ben flugelhorns in the 20s was a good thing. you know, I was like, do you want the score to just really pivot there? And I think it was such the right call to not do that, because the way that it's shot in the past versus the present day is also very different. So the present day feels a little bit more handheld, and the past is like very stylized. It's quite cool. And I think also having the music do that was just like a little bit unnecessary and a little bit too on the nose. So kind of keeping, I did draw from the same palette, hopping back and forth. There are some characters in modern day, like the younger generation, for example, like Chloe and Raikou, who I kind of demanded like a sort of different sound. So they have more of like an industrial rock metal sound, which obviously is not present in the past because they didn't exist then. But, you know, there are some more modern elements to some more of the present day timelines. But in the past, you know, it wasn't like a set palette just for the past. Basically, I was just able to kind of make it feel like the rest of the score, coupled with some more kind of experimental stuff, just because the stuff in the past is so, you know, nuts and spiraling, and there's like a whole journey and then going to the island. It's like a crazy story. So it definitely, the music could lend itself to being a little bit more experimental here and there, or stretching the palette.
Well, you know, listening to your music and watching all 8 episodes, I found myself thinking back to Harry Gregson-Williams, of all people. There's something he did with The Martian, this little 2-note rising motif. And I thought, that's either incredibly ballsy or just brilliant. And I think it's both, really. And you have like a little 2-note rising intonation in the opening theme. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on something that's so big and colorful that maybe taking a step back and trying to go simple and baby step into the world of superheroes?
Yeah, so yeah, The Martian, you know, Mark Watney's main theme is just like a rising pattern of kind of fourths. And Harry's concept for that was Mark Watney's character is just so optimistic and so, you know, just like pushing forward despite all of these hardships that he faced. So when I sat down to write the theme for Jupiter's Legacy, I wanted to create a theme for Sheldon and the Utopian, which ended up turning kind of into the show theme. It turned into the Union theme, because the morals of the Union are reflected in Sheldon, vice versa, right? So there was like, I wanted to create something that felt sort of like a superhero theme, not really totally fitting into that box, but just what I felt worked for the character. And that ended up being, you know, this, the first phrase of the theme is all rising, right? And then it kind of comes back down and unwinds that way for the second phrase. Yeah, something in that felt hopeful and heroic to me. When we follow Sheldon around, it often follows him around on a French horn. So like very stereotypical kind of superhero, like the big superhero guy. That was all very intentional so that I could sort of start to unwind that theme. So when he's like very broken down and sort of intimate moments where he's sensitive and fragile, it's on an acoustic guitar or a piano or like another weird sound or something like that. So being able to establish a theme for him and the union that I felt had the legs to go very broad and big in these like big orchestral symphonic moments, and also just be able to kind of fragment them because it is so simple, right? Such a simple theme, but it can be an earworm. So like people can recognize it when they hear it. That was an important thing to me, to be able to create a theme, however simple, however short, that was able to be put through this kind of kaleidoscope essentially. And yeah, my hope is that that was successful, at least for, you know, the main theme, which is probably the theme that is heard the most, coupled with this other little motif, which I call like kind of the adventure motif, which is just like a really short 4 or 5 repeated sequence of notes that is everywhere in the series. Like whenever something is kind of picking up, it's just sort of this germ that you hear. And it's sometimes it's on a synth, sometimes it's on a harp, sometimes it's on strings, like in a big action sequence. But I think having those small seeds that you can really just, that can drive the score are really crucial. And I think the simpler they are, sometimes the more effective they can be. And that's certainly something I picked up from Harry, is just sort of having these really concise, kind of simple melodic ideas. You know, some of his themes are not simple at all. They're quite complex, but something that you can keep drawing from because it has the legs to go the distance. You know, I think that was important for the score.
Well, something else struck me as a point of question. Thinking to what Hans Zimmer did for 12 Years a Slave, he said that his whole purpose of that movie was to stay out of the way of the story. Conversely, he did Man of Steel, which the biggest superhero of all time. So you're looking at the Utopian and the Union and these rich and colorful costumes. So it's very different from, say, X-Men, where they're all in black. Does a visual cue, does a loud, obnoxious villain, does that give you the opportunity to say, okay, well, this guy's big, I go just as big? How does that influence your composition?
Yeah, that's interesting. It certainly does. I mean, the visual cue of it can certainly inform that. For example, Reiku is one of the characters who is just such, she's such a badass, and I don't like to throw that word around a lot, but her character is so tough, and she's very good at what she does, and she's a bit of a criminal as well. So she has this like rough side to her, and that just demanded something else. It demanded something different and bigger, something that didn't really fit into the orchestral palette. I didn't feel like I was getting that for her character. So I was certainly influenced just like kind of by her look and her performance to create this sound for her. Same goes for Chloe. You know, Chloe's character, she has powers, but she's not a superhero, right? So she's the kind of the odd one out, who is a model and she's a drug addict. And she, you know, she obviously has been heavily affected by her upbringing with two parents who were superheroes, and she didn't drink the Kool-Aid, as she would probably say. She doesn't understand why it has to be that way. So her showing her powers for the first time when she's kind of just like walking around, you know, the street, like after coming home from a shoot, like that felt cool and different to me. So it demanded something else. And that's why she got like this kind of industrial rock theme. So I certainly think that does inform a lot of things. I do think there are moments where the music can do the opposite. It doesn't always have to be so on the nose. Like if something's going really big, sometimes you go less. There's a big action sequence in the first episode where all of the superheroes, older generation and younger generation, are fighting Black Star, right? So our big villain of the series. And sort of towards like many minutes into this fight, it's a really brutal fight. Everything feels quite dire. And in that moment, I chose not to up the anxiety. I chose to, you know, I didn't just like, I wasn't pushing drums the whole time. It was just like, this feels dire. I took everything out and I just had a couple of like high string chords that were floating there. And it felt desperate. It felt more emotionally desperate than it would have if I had scored it as like this really big pulsing action thing the entire time. So I think carving out these moments where the music is kind of doing the antithesis to the picture can also help really tell the story even more. So you can't always do that. And I think within the context of a superhero show, this had some moments where I was able to do that, where I was able to really push it. One of those moments being in episode 7, and I won't talk specifically about anything, but there's episode 7 is such an epic journey from start to finish. It's really the standout of the series, which takes place in the past, and our characters are end up on this island, and they, at the end of it, right, they get their powers. It's like the whole story, their origin story, essentially. And the very final scene before they get their powers is no dialogue. And it's just kind of a bizarre setting, as everyone will see. And my intention for that scene the entire time was to write like a big chorale, like a big choir piece using the main theme and just like using it as a way to develop it. And I was influenced to do that because it was so still and it was so strange that it felt like it needed something just as risky, you know, there. It was a risky choice to do that. And luckily, the producers were on board for it, but it's like a bold choice to do that. And it was a bold choice to tell the story the way they told it. So I think even if it doesn't like totally match up with what's going on screen, I think the approach was there for that. Like, they told the story in a bold way and the music is bold in an unexpected way. So there's lots of ways to approach, you know, what the music is doing according to a visual cue, and every composer has their own interpretation of what's best to do in what places. But I felt fortunate that there were a lot of different moments for interpretation in this series where I could either push it really far or I could take a step back depending on sort of what was going on. And emotionally, that was the most important thing to be aware of, because like I said, this is like a family drama and the emotions are kind of like always being with the psyche of the characters internally was the most important thing.
Well, episode 7, in my mind, it had the best music of the entire show or this season. And what was really noticeable is right about the time where they get their powers, it was electronics that sounded almost like sound engineering and sound effects. So did you have anything to do with that, or how did you help craft what made that scene so impactful?
Yeah, there were a couple of scenes like right towards the end of that episode where, I mean, part of what I do is a lot of it is electronic based. Like, I'm very big into synth programming. That's just like an important part of the palette and just like what I like to do. So that was obviously part of the tapestry of the score. There is a scene in episode 7 with a rock wall where the characters, which I'm sure is what you're referring to. So the characters all put their hands on the wall and in order to get past this impasse essentially that they're at. So that was something from the beginning. That scene was something that the showrunner always wanted to be score. He wanted the sounds coming out of the wall, the like diegetic part of it, to all be music. And the intent there was to like kind of give everybody a tone of some sort when they touch the wall, so that when they all touch the wall and they're able to pass and the wall opens, it all comes together in this harmonious way. So designing that was all music, technically.
Wow, okay.
That was all, the sound design was all part of the score. So my idea for that, which was a very composery thing to do, which nobody watching it would know, I was like, okay, well, we have these characters, we're in episode 7, almost all of them have their own themes. So I was like, how do I incorporate each of their themes into the sound when they put their hand on the wall? I want it to feel like purposeful, right? So what I did was, and obviously, like, it has to be practical. Like, we're seeing them put the hand on the wall. It can't be like a melody that plays, right? So what I ended up doing was I took like just a little nugget of their themes. For example, when Sheldon puts his hand on the wall, it's the first two notes of our Union theme played on French horn, just like a very quick thing. And then what comes out of the two notes is a tone, like a kind of belly tone. So you have the horn and then the tone that comes right out of that. And so every single one of those characters has that. So Fitz has a clarinet line, Grace has a little violin harmonic, George has like a little dulcimer plucked thing. So each of them had their own kind of unique sound with a tone coming out of it. And for the whole scene, until those walls open, the tones are just hanging there, right? So, and simultaneously, there is also score going on under it. So being able to design all of those elements to work together and still be convincing as sound design on screen, and also being able to tell the narrative with the score underneath, was a really unique challenge. But honestly, so fun and such a rare opportunity for a composer to be able to do that. It was really wild. And the biggest challenge I faced was, okay, what happens when the walls open, right? So they put their hands on the wall. Some of them take their hands off the wall and their light goes out. So I would reverse the sound, reversed their motif. And there was that sense of design, right? And I was like, when it all works and all of the lights go up and the score really takes over and swells, I was like, what do I do with the tones? They've kind of just been hanging there for the whole scene. So my idea was, take it from being diegetic to being non-diegetic. So each tone, once the walls start to open and all of their lights are on, each tone becomes part of an arpeggiated sequence. So every single note was just like I created as like a pattern, a synth pattern, a belly pattern that just like kind of works with the rest of the score, and it becomes part of the score cue and then just grows and grows, creating this just like huge cloud of sound basically. So the tones were so important for that scene. And instead of just taking them away once the actual physical nature of it was gone, felt wrong to me. Like I wanted to continue to tie that in and create that as part of the narrative in the score. So yeah, I hope that comes across as just like a musical kind of identity in and of itself in that moment.
Well, I'm so glad you shared that with me, because when I saw that happen, heard, saw, whatever you want to say, I basically did a Roy Scheider in Jaws. I just, I couldn't believe that this was happening. And so as, you know, as a creative, you know, one of the things that helps you grow is charting your progress. So do you think that you could have done this 5-10 years ago if you were tasked with the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know I could do it when I sat down to do it. That's the reality. That's the reality of this. Same with the chorale that I talked about. Like, I had sold everybody on this idea, and they loved the idea of it. And I, like, this is the reality of how fragile it is to be an artist, quote unquote artist. Like, sometimes you don't know if you can pull off the ideas that you have. You hope that you can, and it's scary when you feel like you're falling short of that. At the time where I was scoring these big sequences for episode 7, we were really crunched for time. It was, the schedule was getting a little crazy. That episode, I think in total is about 55 minutes total runtime. And it's about 52 minutes of music, of score. And it all had to get done in about 10 days. So it was no joke. Like it was a crunch. And not only is it 52 minutes of music, it's 52 minutes of important, big, big score moments. So that rock wall scene is probably four minutes like total runtime. And that was done in 30 hours, like start to finish done, like recording live, some live people and stuff like that. And I do think that there's something to be said for being crunched for time when you have to do these really important conceptual scenes, because you have to rely so heavily on your instincts, like, and the adrenaline's pumping, and it's sort of like you're kind of, you just have to do it and commit to an idea and make the absolute best of it. So if I was kind of sitting on that for a while and prevaricating, I might have just not have done the best job that I could have. But, you know, thinking about doing a scene like that 5 years ago, I feel like I would have had the same conceptual idea, but I don't think the execution would have been the same. I might think the same thing if like 5 years from now and be like, oh, I should have done, you know, something better for that rock wall scene in Jupiter's Legacy. But we get to a certain point where we have to have faith in our own skills and what we've done up to that point to prepare us for something as demanding and challenging as that, and just hope for the best, because, you know, that's the most you can do. I didn't know what was going to come out. I was so, that entire week that I was working on some of these bigger score cues, that in the chorale, I was totally freaked out. I was like, is this going to work? I don't really know if I'm going to be able to sell this idea. Like, it has to be amazing or else it's not going to convince anyone, you know? Like, it's all well and good if I had this idea, but if I can't deliver, there's no point if the idea was good. So yeah, I think that's something that probably never goes away, unfortunately. I'd like to think that, you know, 20 years down the road, I like to hope I'm still doing this and that I'm more seasoned and can, that self-loathing that I was talking about can kind of just fade into the background. But I know realistically that's not the case. I think no matter what we sit down to do, we're always going to second guess ourselves and be like, did I ever know how to do this? You know, I think Alan Silvestri has talked about this in particular before, where he's like, it just doesn't get easier. And you know what? I think that's a horrible thing to realize, but at the same time, really good, because we're setting self-standards that allow us to keep striving for better. We're always pushing ourselves to be better to a degree that we haven't been before. And I think that's what happened on this whole episode. Basically, I was like, this needs to be better than anything I've ever done. And I want it to be, and I want it to be rewarding for the audience. I want it to feel as great as this episode is, this epic journey. I want it to complement that and really help push that. And so I think maybe all of that pressure and stress I put on myself really just like ended up turning out as being something better than I had done before. And I feel grateful for that process, regardless of how exhausting and terrifying it was. I think if we're not terrified, we're not learning and we're not growing. So it's all part of it.
Well, Stephanie, I thank you for that. I also thank you for teaching me prevaricating. Don't think I heard that before, but I'm going to try to work that into my next conversation.
I hope it's a word. Maybe I just invented it.
So to go out, I'm not going to ask any more superhero questions. Let's learn just a little bit more about you. When you work, you have a job to do. Not all the time your personal life and professional life align. You make music because somebody asks you to do it, but what kind of music do you like? What do you turn on? What do you do when you're not working?
Yeah, great question. For many years, I had a not so healthy relationship where like I just wouldn't listen to music if I wasn't working, because I just felt very fatigued. Just like, you know, there's so much audio stimulus all the time that I was like, the last thing I want to do is listen to music, even music that I enjoyed. I found myself just not doing it suddenly. It wasn't like a super active decision, but I've since like tried to pay more attention to that and be like, you know, there's so much music out there that makes me feel wonderful, so why would I do that? You know, like I always gravitate back to the same music that makes me feel the same way when I heard it for the first time. So like I'm always listening to like Pink Floyd, you know, Led Zeppelin, like random stuff from my childhood, like Blink-182, System of a Down. I just like just a random assortment of music, you know, some of like the symphonies that I played growing up and stuff, just something to just like trigger that memory, that musical connection that made me love music. I'm like trying to do more and more of that. I'm not so great at discovering new music. My husband is much better about that stuff. So, and like him exposing that to me is always a good thing. Aside from music, you know, this business, like, as you said, this job is very demanding, so it doesn't leave a whole lot of free time, but I really try to carve out time to spend with the people that matter most to me, like my family and my husband and, you know, a couple really close friends. Hobbies. I like to cook. I cook a lot. That's always been something that I like to do. So you know, if I like need to close down the studio for a night, I'll just like go and make dinner. Or I got a really amazing smoker recently, so I've been smoking lots of meats. That's been a really fun thing, and it just excites me, and it's a new thing to get involved with. That's like kind of my life, to be honest. I have a dog that I adore, and those are the things that, you know, bring a lot of happiness into my life. And when you do this work, it's so important to really pinpoint your priorities, because, you know, things can just like fade into the background so quickly if you have no awareness of what your priorities in life are, because this can be so all-consuming. It's just the way it is. It's part of it. And if you don't like carve out time for yourself and for your loved ones, things tend to just kind of, you know, just go away. And it's not a good thing. You know, when I started working for Harry full time, I noticed very quickly, like all of those sort of ancillary things in life that weren't terribly important to me just sort of dissipated. And what I was left with was like the core of what is important to me in my life. It's my work, it's my loved ones, and it's cooking. And, you know, like that's, I think, an important thing for us all to find. And as long as you always prioritize those things that are most important to you, that's kind of where you start to have that balance. I don't think I'm very great at that work-life balance. I try to work on it. I'm not very good at just kind of like leaving my mind in the studio when I leave the studio. It's tough for me to kind of turn off the stress or turn off the kind of wheels that are still turning. I'm not great at that. Like that's something that I think I certainly struggle with. But it's all about self-awareness. Life is about self-awareness. It's about understanding for me what's most important, and definitely making sure that I carve out time and space in my life for those things, to keep those relationships going, to give me like space from being creative. That's really important for me. Like, I know a lot of people who just like will always just constantly want to make music. Like they just want to always be doing that. For me, that's not good. Like I need space away from it in order to like be a little bit revitalized and get a new jolt of creativity. Like I need space away from it. So also understanding that was an important thing for me. Like I could slave away for 9 hours and not get anything done because I'm just so burnt out. But if I had taken that day off and then come in the next day, I would have gotten so much more done. You know, like I know sometimes that's an important thing for me to have to do. So work-life balance is going to elude me for the rest of my life, probably, but recognizing those things that are most important and not being afraid to really take time if I can, if I feel like I need time, because there's so much about this industry where people kind of make you feel like it could be taken away from you at any moment. Like you're so lucky to make music. You're so lucky to be creative for a living. And like, if you don't do it, someone else is just going to take your spot. And it's just like this thing that I feel like we're all taught to just like grasp at so desperately and don't ever let it like out of your grasp. And I think that's really toxic mentality. I think like we're people and this is our life, and we need to do what's healthiest for us. And if that means taking a little bit of time off and working on some other things outside of the studio, I think that's great. If that means working in the studio, but like writing an album that has nothing to do with film music, that's great. I think everybody has their own way of doing that. But I think we definitely need to normalize more, you know, not working ourselves to death, because that's sort of just what we all see all the time and feel pressured to do. I'm not saying that means like not working hard, because I mean, sometimes we work 100-hour weeks and that's the way it is. But I think I'd love to hear more people talking more about how beneficial it is to just like step away and not be creative, and how that's kind of a good thing for creativity in general.
Well, let's round this out one more way. I mean, you have a really great personality. It sounds like you have a zest for life. And since 2020 is something that a lot of people want to leave in the rear view, 2021 offers a lot of opportunities. So what are you excited to do this year that you couldn't do last year?
Yeah, great question. I'm excited to be making music with people in the same room again, that's for sure. Last year, you know, with Jupiter's Legacy, I keep talking about this chorale piece, but obviously when I was writing that, live scoring sessions weren't a thing for a while, especially with choir, because I mean, you're just breathing all over each other, mouths agape. So that was not in the cards. So what we had to do for that was find, Jasper Randall found 9 incredible singers, and they all multi-tracked in their own spaces, completely separate from one another. They multi-tracked all of these choir parts, and it ended up sounding like a huge choir, like they were all in the same room. It was nuts what they could do. And, you know, they were also singing on Latin. Like, it wasn't one of those things where it was a simple piece that just kind of like, it sounds homogenous no matter what, like getting those consonances and all these things together. Like, they did an incredible job. I was so blown away by what they could do remotely. It was pretty nuts. That's like, yes, I'm very excited to make music, as I said, in the same space with people again, but understanding that there are other possibilities to this as well, and having people like setting up their own home studios, that's something that I'm excited to bring into 2021 as well, is just a lot of these wonderful performers having their own independent spaces that I could just call up on a whim and be like, hey, do you mind just quickly like tossing up your mic and recording this? I think that's a good thing that has come out of this, is just accessibility to these performers without having to like secure a scoring stage. It's not the same as being, you know, I would have loved to have conducted this big choir piece with everybody in one room. I think that would have been a really nice experience, but I mean, what was accomplished was so far beyond what I thought could happen. So I was really excited for that to come together, and I'm excited for the future opportunities of being able to do that with people in the same room. I'm also excited about some of the projects that I have coming up this year. There's some different stuff that I have never done before. I actually just finished up a DLC for Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which is my first video game. I've never done anything like that before, and got to experiment with like a totally different palette. The cool thing about Assassin's Creed is that obviously it's an historical game, so a lot of the instruments were like of that time period, kind of. So like lots of very old string instruments, lots of vocals, like weird woodwinds. But so much of it was live, just like me banging on instruments and like making weird sounds with it. But the production is hyper modern, so it like kind of had to like be this balance of things. And that definitely pushed me out of my comfort zone, totally different process. And I was excited to do that. I'm also doing another one of their DLCs this year too. So I'm really excited to continue to explore that. And then, yeah, I have a couple just like random projects that are all really different, which excites me. So, I'm doing a documentary feature film for Lucasfilm, which is going to be like quirky synthy stuff. And I'm going to sample like a bunch of robots because it's about robots. That's nice. Like a fun, different thing. And yeah, there's just like lots of fun artistic things that I can't wait to sort of dive into, because I think it's going to be challenging and rewarding. I'm also excited to hopefully take a vacation this year with my family, go up to Big Sur and do some of that. So I'm definitely looking forward to being able to travel again. You know, obviously nobody could travel last year. I haven't taken a vacation in about 4 years. So the pandemic was not the only reason why I wasn't able to travel. So I'm excited to hopefully, be able to just take a little bit of time and do that. What about you, Mark?
Last year was my daughter's 5th birthday, and great. We had planned to take her to Disneyland to surprise her. And sure enough, around May, when looked like this pandemic was not going away, we all got a kick in the teeth and we had to postpone the trip. So I don't think we're going to do Disney, but we're going to do something. I think actually we're putting in a pool right now. So I guess that's the thing that we tried to do last year that we're actually finally going to wrap up this year. So that's our big, that's our great. Big Sur. It's a big splash.
It's a big splash. Yeah. There you go. That sounds very exciting.
Yeah. But other than that, I think Stephanie Ikonomu, we are so thrilled to have you. We're putting this in the can and we're going to put it up right before the show airs, but we're looking forward to seeing your career take off. And if you, going back to the superhero question about the wittiness, are you a capes or no capes superhero fan?
I'm not into the capes. I don't need a cape for the wordsmith nature of my superpower. I think just like a nice thick framed set of glasses, I think will do. And yeah, I think that's all I really need. Just like relying all up there in the head.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to battle wits with you at a future date and time, and I hope to speak to you soon.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.